So the topic that Mike asked me to address this evening, and he titled it Marks of Faithfulness, and he gave me Revelation chapter 2 and verse 10. So let's turn over there, please. Turn to Revelation 2 and verse 10. Whoever gets there first, if you'd like to read it, if you know it by heart, go ahead and quote it. Okay, so we're familiar with that phrase, be faithful unto death, I will give you the crown of life. This evening we're going to go a little bit deeper into that idea of faithfulness. What does that mean? What does it mean to be faithful in this context? Yes. Okay, faithful to the point of death, faithful even if death is on the line, okay? But let me ask a better question. Suppose you were to look at a member of the New Testament church and someone were to say that person is faithful, what would that person be doing that would lead you to draw that conclusion? How can you look at a person and think, you know what, that's a faithful member of the church? Eric?
Doing God's will.
Doing God's will? Okay. And this is super practical. I'm not looking for anything earth-shattering. Very, very practical stuff. Spiritually minded. Okay, that's perfect. Perfect. Okay, so consistency regardless of the things that they're going through, their circumstances. Perfect. What else? I'm sorry?
Their actions and their words line up.
Not hypocritical. Yeah, absolutely. I missed someone over here.
I said the way they speak and the way they act.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, so you could put those two together. You know, the way they speak, the way they act, they're both good. And the way that they do those things are in harmony with across all of the realms and aspects of their life. And so the way that they are with their family, with their coworkers, with their, you know, fill in the blank, they're consistent across all of those realms. That's great. What else? Maybe one or two more. Involved? Okay. Absolutely. And we'll go ahead and make this point now. We can't get beyond that point. That point is absolutely vital. Unfortunately, I think sometimes that becomes the metric. And it's so discouraging and it's so disappointing when people have this idea, especially for like the college age group, for the high school group. Literally all you have to do to be considered a faithful member of the youth group is show up to stuff. If you show up to devotionals, if you show up to worship like Sunday morning, Sunday evening, and Wednesday, you're literally seen as like that's the gold standard. That's the metric by which youth groups are measured. And that's so unfortunate. That's so sad that, you know, that's the standard that we sometimes present to our youth group is like, just show up to stuff and everyone's going to be super impressed, you know, with the life that you're living. And it's sad. We can't get around that. That's absolutely vital, but we can't stop there. That can't be the standard of just show up to stuff. And, you know, all of a sudden you're a locked in member of the congregation. What we're going to do this evening, we are not going to try to cover all of this. I know myself too well. We're going to get more than likely bogged down, but I wanted you to at least have the handout so that you can go through and examine this on your own time if you'd like to. So we're not trying to cover all of this material. So if we get a good discussion going, then we'll prioritize the discussion. But the point of this handout is really just an evaluation of how we can determine whether or not we ourselves are faithful. So some questions that we can ask, specifically like roughly 15 categories of questions across three different realms that we could ask that will give us a very, very good idea of how faithful we are to the cause of Christ. So that's where we're going this evening. This word faithful here in Revelation 2 and verse 10, the definition of the Greek word is included there. It means trustworthy, reliable, believing, sure, characterized by steadfast affection or allegiance to someone or something. A couple of you kind of struck around this, but this idea of being trustworthy or reliable. Regardless of the circumstances, regardless of the situation, there are people in our lives that we know that we can count on regardless of what's going on. It's like you can bet on that person. You can take their word to the bank. If they say something, it's true. They told me this, therefore I'm not going to doubt it, in a sense. As long as that, of course, is reasonable and practical. So what would you say, and I've got a couple ideas there under point number two. What would you say that faithfulness is contingent on? What does it depend on? Very broadly speaking. Eric?
We're pleasing the Father that we stand faithful to Him.
Okay, that's a great way of putting it. If I'm pleasing to God, there's no way I could be anything other than faithful. There's no way I could be anything other than pleasing to God if that's my priority. Very good point. Because He gives us faith? How does He give us faith?
By the reading of His Word. He strengthened it to where that you trusted and believe in it.
Mm-hmm. Romans 10:17. That's right.
To carry it out to others, that's what He wants to do with the Spirit. That's the Lord. Having faith that He's a faithful God and He rewards those who do it to the
Lord. That's right. Yeah. So I've broken it down into two different ideas. It's contingent on fruit production and spiritual maturity. Well, we're not going to look at all of these, but we'll look at a few of them. Turn to Matthew 13, please. So I want to read Matthew 13, 5 and 6. I know that we could spend time looking at the entire parable, but there are two verses specifically I would like us to key in on. Matthew 13, 5 and 6. Okay, so there's no fruit production there. There's no fruit production. They're not growing. They die. And the principle that we want to tap into here from these two verses are, if we're not growing, we're dying. There's no such thing as remaining stagnant in our relationship with God. Either we're moving closer or we're moving farther away. There's no way to maintain a holding position when it comes to our relationship with God. You can't do it. You can't stay still whenever it comes to being in between God and the world. Either we're in the process of moving closer or we're in the process of falling away. So if I'm going to be faithful, there has to be growth. There has to be fruit production. Someone else get John 15, 1 through 6. And then someone else turn. Go ahead, Larry.
The vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away.
Key into verse 5. That's it, Larry. You got it. Key into verse 5 there. Whenever Jesus says, I in Him, He who abides in me and I in Him bears much fruit. For without me, you can do nothing. If I'm bearing fruit, and specifically, for example, we could suggest the fruits of the Spirit, Galatians 5, 22 and 23. If I'm producing those fruits in my life, what does that say about my relationship with Jesus from verse 5? I am what? Abiding, right? I have a relationship with Him. There's a relationship there. I cannot produce those fruits without that relationship. That's like an apple growing on its own accord without being connected to the tree. That doesn't make sense. The only reason that fruit production is possible is because of the tree. In this passage, it's because of the vine, right? Jesus is the vine. We are the branches. We're producing the fruit. But the only way that that's possible is because we're connected to the vine. So in other words, if there's fruit production, that means that we have a relationship with Jesus. We're tied into that vine, into that tree, because that's the only way that fruit can grow. There are other passages there on fruit production. You've got the fruits of the Spirit from Galatians 5. Someone turn to Hebrews 5. Let's think about this idea of spiritual maturity. Spiritual maturity. Whoever gets there, read Hebrews 5, verse 11, and keep going all the way down to chapter 6 and verse 1, please. This ties in very nicely to the comments that were just made about being active in the works of the church, the works of the local congregation. I think sometimes we get this idea that my work stops at baptism. It's like I'm baptized, I'm a member of the church, and now until I hit my mid-70s or 80s, whenever it's time for me to go home, I'm going to be a pew ornament. And that's my job. I ride a pew for the next 50, 60 years, and I'm good. This passage flies in the face of that concept, that I can just sit there and not contribute to the work of the church and somehow be found faithful. Because we're supposed to be pressing on. We're supposed to be moving forward towards spiritual maturity. And I can't do that if I'm not contributing, if I'm not playing an active role in the congregation. We are to be skilled. We are to move beyond the elementary principles from chapter 6 and verse 1. I don't know if there are many things more discouraging than a person who's been in the Lord for 20, 30 years, and you hear them ask the question about what's wrong with going to a denomination, or is baptism really necessary, or is that just a Church of Christ thing? These elementary principles, these ideas that are so fundamental to the Church of Christ, and you hear these people sometimes, and I have no one in mind here, but you hear these people ask these questions, and it's hard not to ask them, how long have you been doing this? I mean, we want to be gentle, we want to be tender, but at the same time, it's like we need to move beyond these ideas, these elementary principles of the faith. Any comments or questions on fruit production or spiritual maturity?
Stephen.
Yes.
Real quick, going back to John 15:5.
Yeah.
When you look at the phrase "ye can," that comes from the same from the Greek word "dunamis." So if you literally translate that, Christ is saying, "Without me, you cannot. You have power to do nothing."
Yeah, which is the same word for the power of the gospel, Romans 1:16. It's the dynamite of God. That's interesting. I'll have to look at that. Good comment. Move down to point number 3 there before we actually get into the questions themselves.
You cannot be just. Mm-hmm. Society cannot be just unless it's faithful.
Okay.
Hebrews here, right where you were in chapter 5.
Mm-hmm.
He'll conclude his thoughts in chapter 10, verses 38 to 39. And he quotes in chapter 10, 38 to 39, that principle found in Habakkuk, the just shall live by their faith. Verse 39, he says, we are not of them to draw back into perdition.
Mm-hmm.
He's hammering this principle about how you have to be growing, like you're saying. You cannot stay in the elementary principles.
Mm-hmm.
It is not a just place to be in.
Mm-hmm.
You will not be just. You cannot be just if you don't continue to mature, produce fruit. It all ties it together.
Yeah.
But he says there in the last verse, verse 39, we are of them that have the faith through the believing of the saving of the soul.
Yeah.
That's a very key principle.
Yeah.
The reason our society is not very just right now is because we just simply are not faithful. We're producing godly fruit. Anyway, that abiding principle.
Yeah.
You have power. That was a good point there.
Yeah. Good comment.
What chapter was that?
What chapter was that? Just
chapter
confirm. Chapter
10.
Okay.
38 to 39.
That's right. So let's move down very quickly to number 3. sometimes we also hear people make comments, you know, that, well, I hope I'm going to be saved, or on the day of judgment, I hope I'm going to be found faithful. And the cool thing specifically about the book of 1 John is it really emphasizes this idea that not only can we hope, but we should know. We should know that we're faithful. We should know that if Jesus comes back, I'm not hoping that he finds me faithful. I can know that I'm faithful. I can know at this moment that if something were to happen to me, that I would be saved. Again, not because I'm perfect. We're not suggesting that, you know, I've got this thing really dialed in and, you know, regardless of what happens, I'm going to do exactly what I'm supposed to do. But we are making the point that I'm walking in the light as he is in the light, 1 John chapter 1. That doesn't mean that I'm perfect. That means like that I have the heart of David, right? That doesn't mean that I always get it right. But whenever I do make a mistake, then I make it right. I fix that problem, right? So I can know whether or not I'm faithful. And those passages there in 1 John are very encouraging. Eric, yes, sir?
Well, when we read God's Word, it's a spirit. And it also corrects us and makes us to be faithful because that's where it strengthens us. I have to hear it. And I'm not saying I'm happy that I can just hear it, but I used to see it. But it's just more of a not even a feeling. It's like I feel, not that I feel my spiritual growth, but I know I'm trusting that I'm faithful because I'm always reading it.
Yeah.
Morning, day, and night. And when I get upset or somebody hinders me, I don't know what to do to get that off me to stay faithful to his word, because that's what I'm supposed to do.
Yeah.
To keep reminiscing my mind and my heart, to be my soul, to be also filled of it. You know, I want to be, I'm not worried about that I can't see. I don't want to be worried about that I'm about to run into something. I'm just going to worry about the word that I read to strengthen me.
You know, Eric, that ties in very nicely into the first point here underneath personal growth, the letter A there. How often do I pray, study, and meditate on spiritual things? I had this lady growing up in Cleveland, Tennessee, and I would consider her probably one of my first mentors that I just really tapped into. This lady is such an encouragement. She's a very, I don't know if we can word it that way. She's a faithful member of the church, and she was a very big encouragement for me. And so I asked her one day, just out of curiosity, you know, how much time do you spend reading and studying every day versus just thinking about the Word? And she said, I might spend an hour reading and studying every day. And that was far less than I anticipated, because this woman just oozes Scripture. Regardless of what you're talking about with Miss Sherry, she's going to bring it back to the Word somehow. And so that kind of shocked me. I said, you know, I guess I expected that you would spend more than just an hour, you know, reading or studying every day. And she says, well, when I'm not reading or studying, I'm thinking about it. And I think that's the point. It's like, I don't have to spend every waking moment with an open Bible in front of me, but I can be meditating. I can be thinking about Scriptures. I can keep little index cards in my pocket that have verses that I'm trying to memorize and pull those out in traffic when I'm stuck at a stoplight or in traffic. San Angelo doesn't have traffic, but if we did have traffic, then you could do that. So keen into this idea of not just studying and reading, but also meditating, visiting that in our minds. And I think that can be just as helpful as actually having the open Bible in front of us. We can think about Matthew chapter 6 and verse 33 there, a passage that we all know very well. If I'm seeking first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, how is that possible if I am simultaneously neglecting my personal Bible study? I can't seek first the kingdom and also be neglecting my personal Bible study at the same time. It's not possible. So in order for me to be faithful, there's got to be some sort of renewal. There's got to be some sort of study. I can't dogmatically say on a daily basis, but it definitely makes sense on a daily basis. I need to be spending time in the Word. Peyton?
Mm-hmm. The broader context there, that's how you're avoiding sin. And how you're, and let's say, you're like a tree planted by rivers of water.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. By the way, just a quick explanation of the breakdown here. Point number one is personal growth. So these are things that are largely going to be internal, things that other people might not necessarily see. Point number two is going to be obedience. So that's a step outward. People are going to start to see these things, right? These things being enacted in my life. And then finally, point number three is my reputation. So that's fully external. You know, how do people see me? How do people think of me? Because believe it or not, we can't just stop at obedience. It also has to be my reputation. So my faithfulness doesn't just depend on my actions. And it can't. Because think of the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the scribes. And think about the things that Jesus said to them. He says, on the outside, you appear beautiful. Matthew 23, you look great. You look righteous. But if only you were half as righteous on the inside as you appear to be. So in other words, you look like you're doing what's right, but on the inside you're full of dead men's bones. So it can't just be what I'm doing on the outside. It also has to incorporate that personal growth. But then let me make an argument for the reputation also. I didn't really notice it until I started looking into this study specifically. There are probably a good dozen passages in the New Testament that hit home on this idea of my reputation, on the way that people see me, on the way that people think of me. Not in the way that I am changing my behavior because I'm afraid someone's not going to like me based on what I do. But my reputation, specifically with people who are outside of the kingdom, that's very important. Because my reputation is largely going to affect how effective I am in evangelism. If I have a terrible reputation, say as a coworker, as an employee, as an employer, and I'm checking off all the other boxes, but my attitude's wrong, or there's something in my life that is off-putting to people, and I try to bring the gospel to these people, are they going to be open to it? The answer is no. So I've got to incorporate that final point as well. And we'll get into these points in just a moment. So personal growth. How often am I praying? Am I studying? Am I meditating on spiritual things? Number two, letter B. Am I closer to God than I was a year ago? That's a tough one. Am I closer to God than I was a year ago? And think about what that implies. If I have a... Let's really go all the way back to the book of John, right? My ability to bear fruit, bear positive fruit, is connected to my relationship with Jesus. And so if I'm closer to God, if I have a stronger relationship with Jesus now than I did this time a year ago, then doesn't it make sense that I should be able to bear more fruit? Doesn't it make sense that I should be more faithful if my relationship with God is closer and stronger than it was? Am I checked in during worship, or do I let my mind wander? Turn to Revelation 3. Turn to Revelation 3. In this context, Jesus is writing to the church in Laodicea. He has a statement and a question for them. Whoever gets there first, please read that. Revelation 3 and verse 20.
Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and dine with him and he with me.
What is contingent on dining with Jesus? Okay, before the sitting down. Opening the door. So you got to hear the knock and you've got to open the door. In other words, it's interesting that Jesus doesn't say, I'm going to come in and we're going to dine together. He essentially says, if you want to have a relationship with me, you can, but you've got to open the door. I'm not going to barge my way in. I'm not going to force myself on you. If you want to have a relationship with me, you can be exactly as close with me as you want to be. That's interesting. I can be exactly as close to Jesus as I want to be. So really the point based on this question is the ball's in my court. The ball is completely in my court. If I want to be closer to God a year from now than I am today, that is 100% dependent on me. It's 100% dependent on me, contingent on my choices and on my behavior. James chapter 4 and verse 8 is another good one. Let's go ahead and turn over there. And someone read that one, please.
James
James 4 and verse 8.
Draw near to God, and He will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded.
So God's going to draw near to me contingent on what? Yeah, me drawing near first. So it's the same principle that we saw in Revelation 3. He extends the offer. He stands at the door and He knocks, but He's not going to open the door Himself. He's going to allow us to make that first step. So the burden of the responsibility is really on our own shoulders. Any thoughts or comments on that question, am I closer to God than I was a year ago? Yeah.
Meditating has to do with the doing part. Mm-hmm. You're applying and doing it. You're meditating on how to actually apply it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that resonated a little bit. That doing it is the application. That's where you grow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you draw near.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. So you can almost, and I've heard the statement made, there's almost like a delay. You know, so it's like someone obeys the gospel and say they were an alcoholic on Monday and they obeyed the gospel on Tuesday, we can't necessarily expect them to be completely addiction-free and have no problems and have their life completely in order on Wednesday, right? There's a little bit of a delay there. And you see this delay even for us as Christians. It's like sometimes we really have to study something, know it in principle, but then even once we know it in principle, sometimes it takes it a little while to actually be seen in action. We've got to meditate on it sometimes for quite a while before we actually start to see the fruits of that knowledge. So I think that ties in.
Process of growth and maturity. God knows we need to grow and mature.
Mm-hmm.
He's merciful.
Yeah.
Which mercy has to do with time.
Mm-hmm.
Loving kindness allows us time to repent.
That's right.
Time to grow, time to produce fruit.
Mm-hmm.
It's in that heart of David, like you said.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good point. Yeah. And I love this idea because sometimes, you know, we can kind of get this idea that I'm an island, you know. It's like sometimes it feels like I'm the only person that wants to do what's right. I'm the only person that's, you know, trying to please God. But when we have stuff like this, it's like, no, I'm a very small part of a whole, you know. I'm not the only one at all. And it's very, very encouraging to see a congregation who does so much reading. So, very good point. Very good point. Letter C. Do I have my inner man under control? And this is very broad. It sounds kind of specific, but I would say it's very broad. This would include my thoughts, my emotions, my desires, my intentions. It can be as simple as how much traffic does it take for me to blow my top? How much do the kids have to do before I lose my cool or raise my voice? How much does my spouse have to do to annoy me before I lose my temper? Thoughts like these give us a good amount of self-awareness as to how we are controlling the inner person. Our thoughts, our emotions, how much control we have over that inner being, that person inside of us, right? Why do you think that's so difficult? Why is it so difficult to have that inner man on lockdown or under control? And whether you meant to or not, you know, you reminded me of something. think about how much discipline it takes to be a pro athlete. And then whenever you hear about the personal lives of these pro athletes, 9 times out of 10, it's horrifying. So they've got this insane amount of, like, almost like inhuman amount of discipline whenever it comes to training, whenever it comes to diet, whenever it comes to you know, doing everything that they possibly can to be one of the best players in their respective position in the world. But then all of a sudden there's zero discipline off the court or outside of the field or outside of the stadium. It just goes to show that just because one area of my life is very disciplined and very well put together doesn't mean that I'm put together as a whole or that I'm doing everything that I should. Mary.
Matthew 15:18, but those things which proceed out of the mouth come from the heart, they defile
man. That's a good one. Matthew 15:18, if you didn't hear, it's a good cross reference to throw on under letter C. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, very good point. From Proverbs 4:23. Very good point. Eric.
The spiritual man keeps that old man in the grave, so you mm-hmm. go back to doing things that you used to do. So it gives you self-control because when you're in the spirit, you do what our Lord said that you are to become like this.
Yeah, and the tough thing about that is just because you put that old man in the grave, sometimes he likes to pop back up out of the ground. But we've got to keep putting him down. It's a constant death. It's a consistent desire to put that old man away. So the old man of sin, we're not going to let him return, not going to let him show his head again. He has to stay put away. We have to keep him under control. And then, of course, this would not only deal with my emotions, but also my desires, my lusts, the things that I desire to have that I should not have. Those things need to remain under control. Letter D, am I developing the fruits of the Spirit? So the fruits of the Spirit, that phrasing there might be a little confusing. The word fruit there actually just means the product of the Spirit, the yield of the Spirit. So we're not talking about apples and oranges. We're talking about essentially what's made manifest by having the Spirit active in my life. I have a relationship with Jesus. I'm part of the vine. Therefore, what am I going to see active in my life? Galatians 5:22-23, right? So it's the product of the Spirit. It's the yield. It's the result. That's probably the best word. It's the result of having the Spirit in my life because I have a relationship with Jesus, right? Because I'm coming into contact with that word on a daily basis. Then you could also tie in the Christian graces from 2 Peter 1:5-8. I did want to get to letter E, and this is one that I've been thinking about for probably 2 or 3 weeks. In times of stress and struggle and trial and loss, I think you can really see what we're made out of when it comes to our relationship with God. You know? How do we respond? How do we react? Do we choose to draw closer to God, or do we choose to isolate ourselves from God? Sometimes we do become angry at Him. You know, you let this happen to me. You let this come into my family. You allowed all these terrible things. You know, I've been serving you faithfully for X number of years. How could you do this to me? And that's the exact opposite response that we should have. And I've been meditating a lot on, Psalm 23:4. Go ahead and turn over there, please. I've just never spent a lot of time thinking about this specific verse, but it's so incredibly encouraging. Psalm 23. Whoever gets there, just read verse 4, please. Okay. Based on this verse, does the shepherd do anything to prevent the sheep from going through the valley? No. What's the comfort? Because the theme of Psalm 23 is all about comfort. What is the comfort that you find in verse 4? He's leading me, right? And so it's like, okay, you're going to go through the valley. But whenever that takes place, I'm going to be with you. Hebrews 13, 5 and 6. He's not going to forsake us. He's not going to leave us, right? So why is it that whenever we're going through the valley, sometimes people so often want to break off from the shepherd? It's like the only reason you're safe in the valley is because the shepherd's with you in the first place. The worst possible time that you could choose to break away from the shepherd is in the valley. Because I promise you, whenever you break away from the shepherd, you're going to stay in the valley significantly longer than you would have if you just stuck with the shepherd. He knows the way out of the valley. We don't. So stick with the shepherd and he'll lead you out the quickest way possible. But as soon as we start diverting, we start doing our own thing, we wander away, we're going to be in the valley a lot longer than we would have otherwise. He doesn't promise to keep us out. He just promises to walk with us. And so bring that forward into a point of application. Whenever things start going sideways and the temptation is to break off and to do our own thing because I'm mad at the church or I'm mad at God or I'm, you know, mad at fill in the blank, it's the worst possible decision that you can make. Because you're just going to stay in the valley longer. It's just going to make it more difficult. Yes, ma'am. That's true. That's a very good point.
When my mother died, mm-hmm. like the first person I lost, and I had been taking care of her. You know, anyway, some other things started happening in our family at the same time, and I thought, how? I knew I wasn't going to leave God, but how do I know He's with me? And I kept a calendar, and I started writing down every day the people that called me, sent a card, whatever encouragement I got, and I thought, this is the way that He's choosing people to encourage me, love me, support me through this time.
Yeah.
And where I don't know what I would have done without them or that.
Yeah. That's interesting that you make that point, because when things start going sideways, what is sometimes the first thing that you see someone doing? The attendance starts dropping, right? They were there three times a week. They were there at devotionals. They were there anytime the doors were open. But now all of a sudden you might see them once every few Sunday mornings. We can't isolate ourselves, because the point that you just made is the church is one of the tools that God uses to keep us faithful. And so if I take out my problems on God and the church and I decide that I'm going to break away and isolate myself and do my own thing, I'm just going to stay in the valley longer, because the church is engineered to help me get through the valley. That's part of why we come forward to worship. That's Ephesians 5:19, Colossians 3:16, where we're singing. Yes, we're singing in worship to God, but at the same time, we're communicating with each other. You know, whenever we sing songs about heaven, that's not just for God's glory. That's also for our own encouragement. That's something that we need, because it helps us get through the week. It helps us get through that valley. Proverbs 3, 5, and 6, you see the point made that God wants us to trust Him. God has done absolutely everything that He can to help us trust Him. He's always been trustworthy. He's never been untrustworthy. So because of that, we can rely on Him. We know that He's good. We know that He's sovereign. And we can rely on those things whenever times get difficult. Kind of coasting.
You have nothing really showing for it. Whereas even yeah. if you go through those times and it's something bad happens, you're like, why'd you let this happen?
Mm-hmm.
You have faith in Him, and you at least have that, you have that fallback, but then you see something that leads back to that growth.
Yeah. Okay, good point. Eric, did you have something?
Yeah.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
That's why we study the Old Testament. I'm in the Old Testament right now. I do Bible study twice a week with Joyce and Preacher. And I use the Old Testament to, you know what I mean, keep me balanced in the way that I should be thinking of what I don't want it to be like. And that was part of what I saw, that I want to get understanding to not be stuck in something that I need to be out of.
Yeah.
And not let it, you know, hold me down or hold me back.
Who are you?
That's
right.
First, song in our phone book illustrates what you're saying.
Yeah.
Today I'll do it over thee. You don't say it much, but it's the first one in the book.
Good point. Okay. Anyone else? So this list is by no means exhaustive. It was never meant to be. I just pulled five questions that I thought might be helpful for each section, and that's where I left it. So of course you could probably add 15 questions or markers or, you know, points to each one of these, but I just chose five. Looking at number two under obedience, am I active in evangelism? When did I last play an active role in teaching someone the gospel? And will God be pleased with me if I never help a single person learn the truth? To be honest, these questions, they scare me. Because, you know, to show up in front of God's throne of judgment and to have never played a role in a single person coming to know the truth, he would have every right in the world to essentially ask, what were you doing? that's the equivalent of the person that went and buried their talent, I believe, in Matthew 25. You did nothing. You had one job. You literally had one job and you did nothing. Luke 17 and verse 10, I believe. Yes. Luke 17 and verse 10. Jesus makes the point that if we do everything that we're supposed to do, at the end of the day, we're still unprofitable servants. And so if I do everything that I'm supposed to do and I'm an unprofitable servant, what am I if I don't do anything at all? And hopefully that scares us, but not in a you know, an ooh scary fear, but in a fear that produces action, that makes us realize that this is our job. It doesn't matter how old we are. It doesn't matter how long we've been doing this. And if I've been in the faith for a year and I can't tell another person about what I did to become a Christian, that's the Hebrews 5 principle. There's something wrong there. If I can't share the things that I've learned over the course of a year with a person with the intention of helping them learn the truth, then something's going on with my growth spurt. We have to be active in evangelism. It's Mike just told me a quote that he heard probably two or three days ago, and he said it's not the Great Commission, it's the Great Commission, not the Great Suggestion or the Great Intention. It's the Great Commission. He charged us. He told us, this is my expectation. Go and make disciples. And if we never help a single person become a disciple, I would argue we can't be seen as faithful. We cannot be seen as faithful if we do nothing in evangelism for our entire lives. Hey.
You think about Paul's statement in Romans not being ashamed of the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Consider Mormonism, which is a false religion. They go out, they plan 18 years, they go for a 2-year mission. I think on average the typical missionary will convert 2 to 3 people.
Mm-hmm.
But they're teaching absolute nonsense.
Yeah.
If they put a priority to teach absolute nonsense and then proselytize it,
mm-hmm.
how much more so for us, having the true gospel, should be up sharing it and converting it.
And they are almost always one of the fastest growing religious groups in our country. Yeah, very good point. And what is the passage where Paul says, "Woe to me if I don't preach the gospel"? Is that passage in Romans?
1 Corinthians 9:16.
So we make that point about evangelism, but we can't stop there because that's not the only work of the church. Evangelism is important, but question number two: am I active in edification? edification. That is, do I prioritize worship, Bible study, and times of unstructured fellowship? And of course, sometimes we can, you know, hear the argument made, well, the elders have asked us to come to worship, and that's true. So Bible class, you know, is it really required? I don't know. I'm not concerned about that. That shouldn't even cross our minds. The elders didn't require me to be there, so I don't really have to be there. If I'm seeking first the kingdom, I need to be there. I need to be here. If I've got something else going on that I just can't avoid, okay, maybe we can talk about it. But, you know, if it's little Susie's birthday party and it starts at 5:45 and I'm just going to skip Bible class because it's like, well, you know, it's little Susie's birthday party. It only comes around once a year. I'm missing the point. I'm really missing the point. I have to be seeking first the kingdom, and that should be reflecting in how I prioritize worship, Bible study, and fellowship. Do I seek opportunities to encourage the brethren, or do I isolate myself? That question was engineered to step on my own toes. Because that can be a fault of mine, is I like to, I can sometimes be withdrawn. I don't start conversations. I typically just take care of my responsibilities and go about my way. That's not right. I need to be with the other sheep. I need to be encouraging. I need to be asking questions and being involved in people's life rather than just isolating myself and doing my own thing. So evangelism, edification, and benevolence. We'll conclude with this one. When did I last grow in my giving? When did I last grow in my giving? There's not a percentage. It's not 10%. You know, the New Testament doesn't set a percentage for us. It's like, well, this is how much you're supposed to give on the first day of the week. That's not what we see. And so ultimately, it's up to us to decide how much we're going to give. And the passage that we read this morning in Corinthians chapter 16 is as you have been prospered. But say you and your family sit down and it's like, okay, collectively we're going to give 11% of our income, of our weekly income. That's how much we're going to give. But the 11% remains stagnant for the rest of our lives. We need to grow. And I think that growth needs to be included in more than just our evangelism or in our personal growth. It needs to be reflected in our giving as well. That should be something that I want to grow in. I want to improve. It's like past 10 years we've been giving 11%. This year we're gonna try 12%. We're gonna see what we can do. We're gonna cut some things back if we have to, but we're going to grow in our giving. You see the example of those in Macedonia giving out of their deep poverty. I would dare say that the vast majority of us are not giving out of deep poverty. So we can grow in our giving. We can improve in that. Mary?
Yeah, it absolutely is an attitude problem, and it's something that I'm personally very guilty of. But it reminds me of Haggai.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When the people were rebuilding their houses and building up for themselves, but not rebuilding the temple.
That's right. Yeah, very good point. Very good point. And by the way, benevolence is not limited to how much we throw in the plate on Sunday mornings. Benevolence can be a lot more than that. I will here include a not-so-subtle plug for foster care, for considering adoption. For if you can't do those things, we have there's a foster closet here in San Angelo. You can donate your clothing to them, and they give... they give clothing to those new foster parents who get a placement. You know, sometimes you get I think we got Jeremy at like 2 or 3 in the morning. And so like the next day, it's like we have zero baby clothes. We don't have anything that we need for a baby. And so the foster closet, I think they ended up giving us like, there's all sorts of things that they helped us get. So we have a foster closet here that you can donate to. So grow in benevolence. Letter D, have I rid myself of my pet sins and addictions? Am I becoming more successful at overcoming temptation? And then finally, point number 3 is the reputation. That's all that we have time for. We've already gone over. Are there any closing comments, questions?
Yeah, I think that's a good
Okay. I hope the study was helpful. And if you want to hold on to the sheet, you're more than welcome to. So.